Now, a court in Pakistan has sentenced a former university lecturer to death for blasphemy.
Police in the Republic of Ireland are investigating a popular British comedian for blasphemy.
Well, tens of thousands of people in Indonesia have marched against the governor of Jakarta, accusing him of insulting the Quran.
It's everywhere, and no country or group holds a monopoly on it. But where does racism come from, and why is it so hard to confront? This is Global Affairs Today. Let's start the conversation. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm your host, Imani Cherry. In more than 70 countries of the world, simply expressing religious doubts could land you in prison or even worse. And in some of these places, the so-called blasphemy or apostasy laws actually carry the death penalty. Today we're exploring this global human rights issue, but we're taking it a step further. We're delving into the attitudes and the prejudices that drive these blasphemy and apostasy laws. And we're asking, should we be doing more in our own communities to make sure no one experiences discrimination because of their beliefs or non-belief? To get us started today, we're talking with Anne Buwalda, Executive Director of Jubilee Campaign USA. Welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be here with you.
Now, your organization has been engaged with this issue for some time. So help us understand the human costs of these laws.
Yes, actually, my very first case back in 1993 was that of Tahir Iqbal. He was a poet, but he also was a man in Pakistan who, a Christian man, who was accused of blasphemy. And he ended up being imprisoned and poisoned while his case was being circulated through the courts within Pakistan. It's very, very sad. That over the years, the situation in Pakistan has grown worse day by day. Back then, there were two or three cases in prison. As of last year, there were 40 prisoners in Pakistan, one of the 70 countries you mentioned earlier that has a blasphemy law. And these cases are significant because they impact people and their families and their children. Right now, there's a couple that's in prison, Shagufta and Shafiq, and they've been in prison since 2013 when they were arrested for blasphemy. The accuser said that they had text messages criticizing Islam and the Holy Prophet Muhammad. That was the accusation brought against them. Interesting that they accused him of text messages since both Shagufta and Shakil, they're both illiterate. So how could they possibly be engaging with text messages? Nevertheless, they were tortured while in prison. They actually strung Shafkat upside down and beat him in the jail. He was in a wheelchair. He was already handicapped before that. They just made his condition worse. They forced him to admit guilt. And then his wife, Shagufta, was told that they would march her through the town naked if she didn't confess. So both of them confessed. And in 2014, they were found guilty. Their cases are still pending before the high court in Pakistan. They have four children. The children are with relatives. It's a human story, and it's very tragic. Conditions in prison in Pakistan are horrendous. Very paltry conditions. Relatives have to bring food to the prison for prisoners as a general situation. But in their situation, it's compounded by the fact that they've been accused of blasphemy. In Pakistan, many prisoners are brought to the place where other prisoners poisoned them, like the first case I mentioned so many years ago, who was poisoned while in prison. That happens. There's a case back in the 90s where a prisoner was shot dead while his case was being pending in the courts in Pakistan. There's many, many true and real life stories of how this impacts real people.
So you mentioned the families earlier. What is the impact, not just only on the people that are accused, but the families and the communities that they're in?
Excellent question. Many times the communities are completely uprooted when there's a blasphemy charge. There have been a number of situations, and my focus is on Pakistan. There are, as you mentioned, many other countries, even neighboring Bangladesh, that have such cases. But since my focus is Pakistan, I'll just mention, over the years, there are many large events that have taken place, starting with a blasphemy accusation against a Christian in a village. And typically, many of the villages will have a predominantly Christian population. So if someone in the village is accused, the entire Christian village gets burnt to the ground. And that's happened numerous times. It's happened back in 1997 in Shanti Nagar. It's a famous case where hundreds of Christian villages, communities homes in the community were burnt to the ground. There's Gujarat that took place in 2009. Likewise, hundreds of Christian homes and their businesses burnt to the ground. And in that situation, 8 Christians were actually burnt in their homes. They were killed in their homes because of the aftermath. Rioting often happens. I've actually gone to Pakistan and visited soon after the riots have taken place. And, you know, the destruction that happens when an angry mob incinerates the Christian villages, their churches, their homes. It's just a real, real tragedy. And once the families are uprooted, where can they go? That's a huge problem. They often are relocated. They don't have contacts where they're relocated. They can't get jobs. It's not like where, oh, you just make an application. You know, in a country like that, oftentimes it's difficult to get jobs generally as a Christian. So many of them work in very lowly types of, they're often referred to as sweepers because that's what they do. They are almost subjugated to just being able to get jobs in janitorial type circumstances. So it's very difficult. And often entire communities are uprooted, which is very difficult for the Christian believers that are there.
And those stories are so heartbreaking and tragic. And we truly thank you for what you are doing to bring light to these issues and what Jubilee Campaign is doing to bring light to these issues. Thank you so much for taking the time out today.
You're welcome.
So we're taking a quick break, but when we come back, we'll get deeper into our discussion about blasphemy and apostasy laws. Stay with us. Welcome back. We're talking today about the human rights tragedy of blasphemy and apostasy laws. And to help us understand this issue better, I'm glad to welcome two guests. Rachel Deitch is Director of Policy and Social Justice at the American Humanist Association. And Jennifer Hawks is Associate General Counsel for the Baptist Joint Committee. Welcome, ladies.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So let's start off with this question. Very simple, but many of our viewers might not understand what apostasy and blasphemy mean. So what are they? How do we distinguish between that? Jennifer, I'll start with you.
Sure. Apostasy is when you are punished by the government for changing your religious beliefs. So changing from one religion to another, or from identifying as a person of faith to a person of no faith, or vice versa. Blasphemy laws are laws that penalize activities that degrade or demean or insult or offend religion. And of course, the determining body for that would be the government magistrate or judge who might be hearing the case.
So, Rachel, give us a sense of how common are these issues globally? I know the mainstream may not talk about it as much as you may like.
Yeah, absolutely. So the more we learn about blasphemy laws and the more we find them
embedded in other kinds of laws like digital security laws, the more we can really understand the extent of this problem. And to date, I think there's more than 80 countries around the world that have blasphemy laws on the books. And the impact there can be really severe, everything from just a fine all the way to a death sentence.
So, Jennifer, how are some of these laws misused? You know, Rachel mentioned that they're baked into other laws that might, you know, be about something else like social media. How are they misused?
Well, the most obvious people affected by these laws would be religious minorities within communities. But as you said, they're also misused. So we have seen cases where a business owner wanted to expand his shop and either his neighbor wouldn't agree to sell or he just didn't like his neighbor. So he accused his neighbor of blasphemy. So the neighbor gets arrested, is in jail, and suddenly that property is now available for the business owner to expand his business. So we have seen it used to settle political scores. If it's a political rival and you're not sure that you're going to be successful in the engagement, you may accuse your opponent of a blasphemy law, or you may manipulate his videos so that it looks like the candidate has engaged in blasphemy. And what's really sad and frustrating is even in cases where it begins, where it comes out that video had been intentionally manipulated or someone had been falsely accused, that the person who was falsely accused remains in jail and often may have to complete their entire sentence that they had been given, even though evidence comes to the forefront that they were in fact innocent from the beginning.
Rachel, give us an example of a case that you've seen that misused one of these laws.
Well, I think these laws, I think beyond being misused, their premise from the get-go is incorrect. People are committing blasphemy and apostasy every single day. So the American Humanist Association feels like any enforcement of these laws is a misuse of our understanding of what freedom of expression should be. So, the example that comes to mind quickest for me is Mubarak Bala in Nigeria. He's the president of the Nigerian Humanist Association. And just by saying that he's an atheist, that he doesn't believe in God, right? He was accused of blasphemy, or excuse me, accused of insulting religion and inciting violence. And he now has been in detention illegally for over 300 days.
In an article you wrote about Mubarak, you said that, and I quote, that we take for granted our ability to voice our opinions on social media free from threats against our lives. What do you mean by that, Rachel?
I think in the United States, we are able to create and engage in a discourse, a civil discourse of what it means to be religious, what it means to be not religious. I can say I'm a non-theist very comfortably, and I feel no threat to my safety when I do that on social media or when I do it in an article published on our blog. But, we see time and again, like Mubarak Bala's case, that can't be taken for granted everywhere, that there are real implications, safety implications, implications for his human rights when he voices those beliefs freely online.
So there's been a lot of pressure through the years within international community about supporting laws that protect religious sensibility. So let's take a look at this clip from a few years back of the United Nations debate on blasphemy laws.
The international community must not become silent observer and should criminalize such acts that destroy the peace of the world.
I call for an international instrument to effectively prevent incitement of to hostility or violence based on religions or belief.
Or protecting religion from defamation is like necessary to protect and prevent against violence. Jennifer, how do you respond to that suggestion?
Well, like Rachel said previously, just the whole premise of government protecting what is true and correct religion is just it's false, and it's not a helpful framework from the beginning. In part because religion is personal, and as a Christian, I know that for my faith to be vital and to be vibrant, it's got to be voluntary. I've got to be able to question, what does it mean to be a Christian? I've got to be able to question, how does the Bible apply in my situation? And if I'm living in a situation under blasphemy laws, I'm not allowed to ask those questions of my own faith. But then also on the flip side, when it comes to protecting safety and security and those kinds of concerns, those are clearly a smokescreen, because even countries that have laws that are neutral on their face, they are only used to protect the dominant religion. So we don't see them used to protect the student at school who's a member of a religious minority who's being bullied for being in that minority. We don't see them used to protect someone who's been fired from a job, who's been accused of committing blasphemy or of changing their religion. So they are used to protect the status quo and to protect the dominant religion, not to ensure everyone's safety. But again, we agree with Rachel that no government should have the ability to decide what is good religion, what is bad religion, what is correct religion, and what is false religion.
We're taking a short break now, but the conversation will continue. Stay tuned. Welcome back to our discussion today of the global tragedy of blasphemy and apostasy laws. We've been talking about these laws within the context of Muslim-majority countries, but in 2017, a British actor, an atheist, was asked what he would say to God if God were real. His response was broadcast on Irish TV, and it led to his investigation under Ireland's 2009 Defamation Act. Let's take a look at this clip.
Caused so viral an explosion on Twitter and elsewhere. Very grateful to the Archbishop of Canterbury, who apparently said the other day that I had every right to say what I said, and I should hope I do. And I'm most pleased, I think, that it's got people talking.
Jennifer, tell us more about these blasphemy laws in the Western context.
A number of Western